Hello, and welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Sarah Silverman.
Hello.
Oh.
Are we talking about murder?
Oh, I love this character. It's like we're all sipping tea with our pinkies out.
Ooh. You know, I really do very few characters, as you know, but I like doing a rich, appalled late. I find when I'm around toddlers and even younger babies that they love the sound of an appalled rich lady.
Oh.
So they love this. Boo!
Well, Jessica lately has been saying that she belongs in Bridgerton, that new yes. TV show. Right.
Yes, and that is the actual accent is what we're getting at.
Well,
here.
I haven't mm-hmm. watched it, but everyone's talking about it. So honestly, how do they speak?
It's very, very so British, but angry.
And the Queen is very, very mm-hmm. So that's
we
just what
right
I want to bring to the table. And I feel mm-hmm. like Sarah brings it to the table in a better way.
It sounds like it's almost like a Gossip Girl, but they're all putting on fancy accents and time period clothes.
Yeah, and the mm-hmm. worst thing about it is that when I watched it, I'm an accent ho. I love accents. So, but when I watched it, I was like, oh my God, that guy is doing the worst British accent. And he's actually British. And he's British, by the way. So I'm a bit of a douche.
But in your defense, I would say there are several regions and several classes and several types
Indeed.
Of posh and not posh British accents that if they were born and raised with one, like, it's like me doing a Southern accent or people doing a Boston accent or, you could still be shitty at it.
What is your favorite accent, Sarah?
I very much like the Boston accent. That's probably just from the region we're from and like mm-hmm. feeling like it's so, I imitate my dad, but I'm still, it's very hard.
You heard the episode you told me that you heard the episode with Mario and we went into that quite a bit. We're like, yeah, Tommy. Yeah. I was telling Jessica all the time, I really hear it on my O's when I'm tired, confidence.
Yeah. No, that was on the podcast.
Yeah. So.
On.
Yeah.
A lot of AWs in replace of O's and.
Uh-huh. Well, Killers, for those of you who don't know, Sarah and I go way back. I knew Hall Wen. We're both from New Hampshire. Our moms worked together at Notre Dame College. We did some theater together. We went for a joyride together through Valley Cemetery on Chestnut and Valley. You were driving. I thought we were going to die, just so you know. You don't remember that at all.
Was I on marijuana?
Probably. Maybe. I can't say.
I was driving. Was it my 1977 Mercury Monarch, the first car I bought?
It was big. It was like a boat. It was a boat, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A big white car with a maroon top I mm-hmm. bought from like a 90-year-old lady. It had like no miles on it.
Well, I kind of loved it, Sarah, because I was so, like, I was so repressed and nerdy. I was like, she's so exciting, and she likes to live. Look at her go.
That's so funny.
I don't know if you remember this. We took an acting class. I've been wanting to talk to you about this for 35 years, to see if you remember this. With this woman
Bob
named...
Bob Shay? Oh,
no. No, with Eleanor Lenke. She was this woman in her 70s with red hair. We were 15 years old, and it was at Notre Dame College. And I'm going to remind you, I think you and I both told our moms we didn't really like the class because she had this technique, Jessica. I see her mouth is open.
Eleanor Lenke. I haven't heard that name since then. This is all...
Uh-huh.
I'm having a...
Coming
like,
back to you. You
memory.
Remember her. Okay, and she... Remember she did this thing where she would make you move
Don't
physically.
Tell me that. No.
No. She would say, move your arm or your leg, take a step, freeze, and then speak. She wouldn't actually let us move and speak at the same time. And it drove me crazy. Do you
I
have
wonder
any
what
memory
that was supposed
that?
To teach us.
I don't know. It was some sort of technique, but...
Do you still think about that when you do shit on camera?
Well,
or on stage?
Clearly, she's an Emmy winner. I'm a Tony nominee. I think it's Eleanor Lenke that got us there.
I mean, clearly.
I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say, don't move it. Move it or lose it. is where
never move and talk at the same time. That's not how people people move and then they talk.
Yeah. Same arm, same leg. Same arm, same leg.
Anyway, God bless Eleanor Lykke. Well, Sarah, you are an incredible actress, comedian, playwright whose show The Bedwetter we cannot wait to see. It was based on a book you wrote, is that right? Or
I wrote a kind of a, I thought of it as a collection of essays, and it turned into a memoir. And then Adam Schlesinger, 8-9 years ago, came over and he was like, this is a musical. The chapter titles are songs, you know, cursed from the start, you know, whatever. And we worked on it for, you know, it's been like 8 years, and now it's been pushed, you know, because of COVID, of course. And it's not the whole, it's not like my life story or anything. And it's just the year I'm 10.
Awesome.
And I'm not in it, of course.
No, I know. But you actually cast our fellow true crime podcaster, Ellen Marsh, from the Disappeared Pod, I think was supposed to be in it.
And, yes.
We really cannot wait till this whole, as Jessica says, Coco Roro, she calls COVID the Coco Roro, is over so that we can have you back in New York City with this musical.
Ellen Marsh, yes, boy. It was one of those like audition sessions, which is so uncomfortable when you're on the other side of people auditioning. I just like, I can't bear it because, you know, I know that energy. So, you know, you just, ugh. But she was like just the only one who was just like, as soon as she left, we were like, oh, we're done.
Good.
Like, oh, phew.
Snaps for you, Ellen.
Yeah. Hey, Ellen. Hey, girl. How you been?
Hey, girl. Hey. And you are, and so many things about you, Sarah. You're an activist. I just love
We wanted you to come in, but you're busy.
Oh, was
doing
I?
Doing a little play called Company, I guess? Or?
Oh, my God. Sarah, I didn't know that. Well, I'm just so excited for us to be in the same community for a hot second because we've sort of just been ships in the night, and I'm so proud of you and all of your success.
I'll come in.
Jess will do it.
She's a veil. Tony Nam, but I am a billboard artist.
Yes.
God damn it, bless.
I mean, I'm in awe of you guys. It's so cool. And the worst thing about this musical is it stars mostly very young girls, and I am guessing that with a 2-year delay, like, we're going to have to replace some of them for the crime of growing.
Well, the crime of growing is awful, which is why I believe in Botox and filler. And I, I don't think it's a problem to just say.
Do you really? Because I'm truly thinking.
Yes,
Sarah. I never thought I would, but the softening of my jaw has made me sad.
Yes.
Yeah, let me tell you
what
something.
What do you do to just make this tight?
The way you do it is way back here on the mandible. If you inject, I have not done this yet, but if you inject it up here, if you inject it here, it lifts.
What,
this
Botox?
No,
filler.
Filler.
And I will tell you, Sarah, that the tear trough filler, the under eye, life changer.
That's what
changer.
I heard.
It really is.
My dermatologist, who I just go in for checks, but I get my facials. I haven't since COVID, but from a lady in that office, Louise. But he's like, eventually you're going to have to get under your eyes. That's the telltale, you know.
I will
You know what I wouldn't be afraid of? Getting filler in my hands. Because that can get fucked up as long as my hands work. But
they have that now, too.
They got everything.
Yeah, when I see my hands, I go, ugh.
All right.
No, I haven't done anything, but I think I will. I'm just so
Jess
afraid
and I
of looking like...
I know.
A crazy person. I
Us
wanna
too.
Look my age. But I just want to have a little bit of a tighter.
No,
jawline.
That's the thing. It just picture an empty wallet, and you're just putting a little money in it, just to fill it out a little bit. That's
all. But that's also why you got to go to the person who's like, you got to go to the person who's tasteful enough and who's not like, let's not always look like we're surprised. We don't need to always.
Yeah, I need to be able to move my face.
Exactly.
Exactly.
You need
a little
sizzle.
We've all been inundated with the horror stories and the horror photos. But if you're really, really subtle and discreet about it, it makes you look like you had a good night's sleep and you can still move
your face.
Because
you know what? I see changes in my face. Like, I like the way I look. I'm fine. But, like, the changes in my face I see, I go, I wonder if I would think that I did something because my face looks different from aging. Like, it's more chipmunky, you know? But I don't know what...
When you got on the call, I thought, where's Sarah? All I see is a chipmunk. So I'm glad.
Like, where's the monkey? This is a chipmunk.
Yeah. You're beautiful.
I mean, I'm serious, though.
I'm confident in my... I feel good about my looks, but, you know...
Well, you're a beauty, but I digress.
Well, and let's get us going here, because we want to let Sarah...
We have a murder to talk about.
We do. And as I said before, you are so many things, including Emmy Award winner, but we should move on from your incredible resume to talk about true crime. Right, Jess?
Absolutely correct. Sarah and I do not go way back, killers, but... after this episode, we will. And
Sarah, you might understand it already that Jen and I love to discuss true crime. We happen to be obsessed with it. We're not sure why. We often wonder, have we been serial killers before in a past life, in a sleepwalking episode? Have we driven through Valley Cemetery and run people over? So we always ask our guests, are you interested in true crime? If you have any sort of interest in true crime, is there... something that sparked it? Are there things that you specifically love to watch?
Well, I'm not really into true crime. I'm very excited to talk about this today and to talk about true crime, but I'm not as into true crime as I am in pretend more softcore. Like Law and Order is ripped from the headlines, but it's very softcore.
Yes. That's okay.
Every night we end the night with a Columbo from the 70s. I very much enjoyed, seeing a Ruth Gordon plot a brilliant murder, mm-hmm. and then watch Columbo kind of dismantle it and figure it out,
Same.
I'm interested in cold cases. I'll watch a Dateline here and there and stuff like that, and I do enjoy stuff like that. You know, it's the husband or the wife. But yeah, I like the pretend version of the real thing. Like, for instance, this crime was made into a movie mm-hmm. called To Die For, which I think Buck Henry wrote with Nicole Kidman and Matt.
Mm-hmm. Matt Dillon.
Dillon. And Joaquin very Phoenix. Young, very real, like you think they just hired a real kid, Joaquin Phoenix, mm-hmm. even though it's post-parenthood.
Yeah. Good answer, because... we often ask people here, are you even interested in it at all? Because it's very scary. And these are real people.
I loved The Staircase. Like, I do like stuff like that. But, I wouldn't say I'm as obsessed with true crime as many people that are way into it. But I'm into this area.
And I'm with you, Sarah. I actually just booked a job recently, and I was quarantining for it. And all I watched while I was quarantining was the old Columbo reruns. I started at number one.
No!
Oh, yes. I had watched all of them, 20 years ago, because we were very young when it came out. So I didn't watch it when we were little. But I watched it, in my early 20s. And I just started. And I love how the actors are repeat guests. Jack Cassidy, for example.
Yes.
Right?
William Shatner did, too. Oh, yes. Two different people.
I just watched the one yesterday where and I'm not finished. I have 20 minutes left.
Shoots. You're watching this, too.
Yeah. Where he shoots his wife in the deli.
Yes, we just watched that like 3 nights ago.
Yeah. It's a New Hampshire thing, I guess. That's what we do.
That's so funny. Well, my dad, so I told my dad we've been watching Columbo. He goes, "Oh, we watched every Columbo. Your Uncle Louis came over and we would watch Columbo." He goes, "Name any Columbo and I'll tell you the rest." And I go, "The one with where Ruth Gordon is," he goes, "I don't know that one, next." And every single one I mentioned, he goes, "I don't know that one, next." He didn't know any of them out of like 8. I go, "Wow, well, really impressing me, Dad."
Oh, well, as we discussed, you grew up in New Hampshire, and this case, I almost chose this one for our first episode, Jessica, and it was about 10 miles from where I grew up, but we decided to save it for a rainy day / a special guest, and that day is today. It's a really famous case, and as Sarah was saying, it spawned several movies, including To Die For. Inspired that movie, as well as Murder in New Hampshire, the Pamela Woges Smart story, which starred Helen Hunt and Chad Allen, which I remember seeing in real time. Yeah. Do you remember? You obviously remember To Die For. Did you not see the one with Helen Hunt?
Or? No, I want to see that one.
I think you can find it on YouTube.
I think it's our homework. I think mm-hmm. I'm ready for it. I'm ready.
Yeah. And when this crime took place, had you moved? You had moved to New York by then, right, Sarah?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you remember this case?
Yeah, because it was New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And, you know, big. Of course it was like, oh, that's awesome. You know, whenever it's a woman teacher and a guy student, it's like, oh, cool, you know, whatever. I remember actually Zach Galifianakis, another case, not that one, like had happened, a little more recently. And Zach Galifianakis had a joke about, that kid actually died from high-fiving. I'm telling it. I'm ruining the joke.
Not at all. Right. Don't sue us, Zach Galifianakis. We are so glad you could join us for this today. Let's get started. But first, credit where credit is due. We got our information from Wikipedia as well as Murderpedia. This is the case of Pamela Smart. Pamela Smart was born Pamela Wojcis in Windham, New Hampshire on August 16, 1967, the daughter of John and Linda Wojcis. She grew up in Miami, Florida before her family moved to Canobie Lake, New Hampshire. Sarah, do you remember the Canobie Lake Park jingle?
The Canobie Lake Park jingle.
But you remember the park.
Of course.
All right. I'm going to start it and see if you remember. Canobie Lake Park. Canobie Lake Park. That was it. That's as simple as that.
Is this a water park? Is it a water park?
Was
it
It's like not a carnival, roller coaster. There was this thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like a boat that rocks.
A very low rent action park, I guess, with no water park, right?
Yeah, like it's not traveling. It's like that one level up from a traveling.
It's not
one.
Quite non-equity, but it's a lort. It's a,
Yeah. So she grew up in Canobie Lake, New Hampshire. When she was in the eighth grade, that's when they moved there.
Pause to ask you another Please. New Hampshire question? Because I don't know anyone that remembers this except for one person. There was a commercial that ran in New Hampshire that was anti-abortion, and it was just a fetus. It was just like a fetus with the beating heart, and then you hear like a 5-year-old's voice go, "Mommy, no."
What?
You don't remember that?
I don't remember that, and I wish I did. That's a really great contribution from... Oh, Sarah, you should know that on our podcast, everyone is an expert. You're Dr. Silverman, and...
finally.
I really, really appreciate...
Mommy, no.
I know.
No.
Well, Louis C.K.'s from that area, too, and he's the only one that also remembers it. And he said he would always just think, like, there was probably a 5-year-old in a sound booth, and they're going, "Now, your mother's trying to kill you."
Oh, my God. No, the only thing I remember as a local, and everyone who's local remembers, is "Star of the Day, who will it be?
Were you never on that show?
No. Were you?
What is that, local Star Search?
I was.
What?
Community auditions.
Community auditions. God damn it. Yeah, I remember.
Go on. He was always drunk. Dave Maynard
was drunk. I got a great turkey recipe from Dave Maynard. The key is cook it breast down on some white bread, and it's very juicy.
You have said this before. This is not the first time.
All right, so we digress. Sorry. We digress. Now,
sorry.
No, please. That's what we do here. Pamela attended secondary school at Pinkerton Academy in Derry, New Hampshire, where she was a cheerleader and graduated from Florida State University with a degree in communications. Now, during her college radio career, Smart combined her passion for heavy metal music with her career aspirations. She hosted a one-night-a-week radio show at WVFS that she called Metal Madness, using the alias Maiden of Metal. Pamela Wojcis met Gregory Smart at a 1986 New Year's Eve party. They formed a serious relationship in February 1987 and married 2 years later. They shared a passion for heavy metal music. Greg even bought her a Shih Tzu, and she named it Halen after her favorite group, Van Halen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, only 7 months into the Smarts' marriage, they began having serious problems in the relationship. One huge problem was that Greg cut his long heavy metal hair short. And Pam did not find that attractive. And around this time, Pam took a job as a media coordinator at Winneconnet High School in Hampton, New Hampshire. Smart met Winneconnet High School student Billy Flynn at, quote, Project Self-Esteem, which is a local drug awareness program at the school in which they were both volunteers. Now, Billy had dark shoulder-length hair and, well, We know at this time what an aphrodisiac that was for Pam, and she was able to impress him with her interest in heavy metal music. Now, side note, Smart also met another intern named Cecilia Pierce, who was friends with Billy Flynn, and the three became quite tight. And for his part, Billy Flynn, who's a sophomore, fell for Pam almost instantly and was always going out of his way to be helpful during the sessions and also visited her every day in her office. And it was one day in her office in early February of 1990 that their relationship took a turn. On this gray February afternoon, Pam turned to Billy and asked, "Do you ever think about me when I'm not around?" "Sure," he admitted. "I'm really glad that you gave me these lines."
Mm-hmm. I knew you would be.
"Do you ever think about me when I'm not around?" "Sure," he admitted. "Well, I think about you all the time," said Pam. And about 3 weeks later, Pam kissed Billy while on his bed listening to Motley Crue's Starry Eyes playing over and over. If anyone wants to do that, now's your chance. And late in March, Pam took another opportunity while Greg was out of state for an insurance meeting and invited Bill and Cecilia over to the condo to watch movies, one of which was the steamy and highly inappropriate to watch with your high school students, 9 1/2 Weeks, starring Kim Basinger and Mickey Rourke.
You guys, just, we always
Sarah's
say this.
Sarah's face.
Her jaw.
Her jaw.
Drop open. Right.
I mean, 9 1/2 weeks. Also, can I say that isn't Billy Flynn the name of the lawyer in Chicago?
It is.
I can't believe I know that.
I know. All right. Well, so bring us around. Where were we?
Well, shortly after the movie viewing, Cecilia walked the dog downstairs and Pam enticed Billy upstairs to the bedroom that she shared with Greg, and she slipped on a turquoise negligee, bought especially for this occasion, and then had sex with Billy while the CD player blasted songs by Van Halen and Sammy Hagar. And after their first sexual encounter, they repeatedly met over the next few weeks to have sex, and when Billy questioned her about getting a divorce, she told him that Greg would follow her everywhere so that she would not be able to have a boyfriend and that she would probably lose the condo, furniture, and that she could not bear the thought of losing Halen. And she falsely claimed that Greg beat her and that the only way they could keep seeing each other was for Billy to kill him. And Pam lamented, "You have to get rid of Greg. If you want to keep seeing me, you'll have to get rid of my husband." What? This is where I go. I'm sorry. Why do we just not? Why do we go to that and say, let's kill? Like, you have to kill him in order to get him out of the way. I can't possibly tell him I want a divorce.
Right. We say that every week. Why? Yeah.
Why? Because she would have maybe lost the condo.
That seems like a good reason.
And the furniture. Don't forget about the furniture. And Halen.
Right. And what about the fact, too, that, you know, like, I know that when it's a female teacher with a male student, as Sarah was wisely saying, there's this impression of like, oh, high five or cool. Like, but it is statutory rape. And it's not sex. It's statutory rape, right?
True. But legally it's true and it is true. And of course, what she's a murderer. But
yeah.
They were oddly a little bit close in age. I mean, they were closer in age than I am with my boyfriend. And that's
wasn't she
like 22?
They were close in age.
That's the same as me, my lover and I.
Oh.
Oh. Is he younger or older, Sarah?
He's younger.
That's right.
Yeah.
He's got gray hair, so it works out.
Oh, sprinkle of salt and pepper. Well, now, going back to Pam's idea, which she couldn't get a divorce because she needed to keep the condo, the furniture, and the dog, reluctantly, Billy agreed to kill Greg, all the while believing that this would keep Pam, you know, very near to him. And twice, Billy aborted attempts to kill Greg, to which Pam was furious, berating him and threatening to break up with him. And she would say things like, "If you love me, you'd do this." And she told him that May 1st would be his very last chance and that Greg had late appointments that night and that she would be busy with a school board meeting.
But when he aborted the attempts, it was a commercial on TV of a little fetus.
Billy, do.
No,
Billy. All right. So Billy enlisted the help of friends Vance Latimé Jr., Patrick Randall, and Raymond Fowler. The plan to kill Greg was simple. Although numerous discussions took place between Billy and co, they settled with Pam's basic plan. That plan included the boys wearing dark clothes, Billy tying back his long, luxurious hair, parking by the shopping plaza, and Pam leaving the cellar door open, as well as the rear doors, for Billy and Patrick to enter the condominium and to ransack it, staging it to look like a burglary and to take anything, including electronic equipment and jewelry. Note, and this is important, that day she wore all her gold chains and a ring on every finger so that she would not lose her favorite pieces of jewelry that evening. Mm-hmm. Billy instructed
it seems like a woman who places things and stuff in high regard above human life.
Yeah.
Yes.
And rather fair. Premeditated. Mm-hmm. So Billy instructed his accomplices with these three prohibitions. Number one, don't turn on any lights. Pam says, quote, Greg is a real wimp. He sees a light on, he won't come inside, end quote. Number two, don't hurt the dog. Put him in the basement so he doesn't have to witness the murder. She doesn't want Halen to be traumatized. And number three, use a gun rather than a knife because a knife is too messy. She doesn't want blood all over that white leather couch.
Oh.
To Sarah's point, that white leather couch is very important. The white leather couch, that is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Her stuff. At some point, Pam asked the teens how she should act when she, quote, discovered Greg's body that night, whether she should scream or call for help. One of the boys told her, just act natural.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
It's nice. It's all really nice. So on the evening of May 1st, according to plan, while Latimer and Fowler were killing time at that shopping plaza we mentioned, Flynn and Randall entered the condominium. They threw the dog in the basement, ransacked the house, and took jewelry and other items. Then the two waited in the dark for Greg Smart to come home. Upon arriving home, Greg turned the key in the lock, flipped on the light while calling out to the puppy, "Hey, Lynn." Billy leaped out, ambushing Greg as he came in the door, grabbing the shoulders of his coat. In the next few minutes, Greg was overpowered by the two youths. At some point, Greg handed over his billfold, and when Patrick told Greg to give them the wedding band on his left hand, Greg said, quote, "No, I can't do that. My wife would kill me," end quote. Isn't that chilling? I know, Sarah's, hand to the heart. Awful.
We've got a look. We've got a very sad look happening.
He was 24 years old. I mean, it's just so tragic. The final words were Billy saying, "God forgive me," as he squeezed the trigger at Greg's head. Yeah.
Well, after this, Flynn and Randall, they ran out of the condo and back to the getaway car where Latimer and Fowler waited, eventually making their way back home. Pam would later tell Billy that while driving to Hampton, she had actually seen their car on the road and had flicked her lights at them in greeting. And at 10:10 p.m., Pam arrived home and upon entering the foyer started screaming, "Help my husband, my husband." She ran to nearby condo unit 4D and then to 4C, pounding on the doors and ringing the doorbell, screaming hysterically, "My husband's hurt. He's on the floor. I don't know what's wrong with him." And police detectives from the outset felt as though something wasn't quite right with Pam's story and her behavior. And there were several, as they called it, red flags, but it was the last of the red flags that really set off the alarm bells. Because 2 or 3 days after the crime, one of the detectives accompanied Pam to the condo to pick up some items. And he witnessed Pam not once, but several times, nonchalantly walking through the blood-soaked carpet where Greg's head had laid. And the detective recalled Pam's mother finally covering the stain with a towel, but that this didn't deter Pam, and she continually stepped on the towel, while everyone else at the crime scene made a point of stepping around it. And one detective commented, "You know, I think she did it." And it was 2 weeks into the investigation with only random leads when detectives got an anonymous tip. A female caller told them that a teen named Cecilia Pierce knew that Pam Smart planned Greg's death with three teenage boys. Then at noon on Sunday, June 10th, more evidence was revealed when Vance Latimer Sr. brought a snub-nosed .38 caliber revolver to the Seabrook Police Headquarters, believing that the pistol might have been a murder weapon. And it wasn't long before the murder case with the Seabrook angle connected Pam Smart.
"Excuse me, ma'am. One more thing.
This is very exciting.
Seabrook, I got arrested at Seabrook power plant.
What happened?
My sister Susie. We were protesting the nuclear power plant.
Wow.
Good for you. God damn it.
Yeah,
you're awesome.
Seriously. That's
how
really
old were you?
17. And I had just gotten my license, and so Susie let me drive. And I went through like 10 stop signs, just so A terrible driver. I soon after got my license taken away for 3 months, and
I'm going to say I agree.
My father wrote a thank you note in the local paper to the police for taking me up the road.
No, Sarah, no joke, we were in Valley Cemetery. I was like, this is it. At least I'm in the cemetery. We'll be quick. Here I am. Hilarious.
Sarah's arrest story is much better than mine for stealing lipstick at Walmart.
Still pretty good though, dude.
Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-STEP, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song,
Killing It. As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-STEP has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers.
Oh, sorry. Smokey just texted in. He was impeached 232 to 197. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a lot of Republicans that came over then. Isn't it?
Yes, it is.
He cannot run again.
I believe he can run again. I do believe he can.
This is only
the 25th makes it so that he can?
That's right.
Yeah. No, no.
They couldn't put that into the articles of impeachment?
I'll explain it. No, he's been impeached by the House, but in order to not run again, it has to go to the Senate. He has to be tried. And then they have to vote on whether to convict him or not, and on that piece of legislation as well, as he can't run again and to strip him of the money and all of that jazz. But so that's to be determined. But step one.
Oh, yeah. We knew the House, right? We knew the House.
Yeah. Y'all, he
was
impeached.
Very good. Which is so very good.
Yeah. Okay. And if you don't like that on this podcast, too bad.
Then this is not your podcast.
That's right.
Not the podcast for you.
No, you're welcome to listen to this podcast, no matter what your politics are. We welcome you. Come sit next to us.
Well, that is true. Sarah is very...
I don't host this podcast. Who am I to say
No. Sarah, on her Twitter feed, one thing that Sarah, I think you posted recently on your Twitter account, I was like, oh, see, that's Sarah and her open heart. She said, come sit with me at the lunch table. I think you said,
yeah,
right?
Well, I believe in change. And I consider myself a democratic socialist, but I feel that some of my brethren are rather elitist. And oddly, for a progressive party, progress, that means progress, that means to change. Mm-hmm. And certainly people need to change before a movement can change. So if you don't believe people can be changed, they have to have a place to be welcome to, or they're not going to leave. These are people that are finding a place of belonging for the first time in their lives. And sometimes it's a hate group. Sometimes it's the drama club. But I feel like you have to go, join us.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say, Joy Reid, I think, made a point similar to yours, which is you have to give them an off ramp, is what she said.
Yeah.
You know, you have to give them an off ramp.
Shaming people, it actually does not help them change.
Agree. I was listening to video footage of a podcast of yours where you were talking about this. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I was very inspired by it.
Well, Sarah has a podcast.
Yeah. No, I know. That's what I'm saying. I was listening to her podcast.
Yeah.
But via like video on your Instagram or something that you posted. But it was about this. It was about talking about maybe someone whose views had changed. I don't know.
Christian Picciolini.
Yes. That's right.
Head of
that's
a KKK
right.
group. Yeah. And
that's right.
For the past 20 years has been helping people leave hate groups.
Yeah. And I was really inspired. I thought that was very, very cool because you just use your platform to actually get through to people in a way that doesn't make them feel ousted or completely outed or like, oh, fuck, am I going to be, you know, completely hated for being who I am, when they're willing to see a different point of view. And that's the hardest.
I call it righteousness porn because I see people of my ilk. There's a porn in it and pointing to someone as wrong so you can point to yourself as right. Instead of wanting that, do you want that person to change? You have to give them some space to, you know, some a place to, I think. I don't know.
No, you're right.
But the lied to, I feel bad for.
It's called the Sarah Silverman Podcast. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Go check it out.
So good. I love it.
Yeah.
I really do.
Thank you.
Where were we?
Well, I'll tell you where we were.
So, yes, they got an anonymous tip that the friend of Billy Flynn and Pamela Smart, the girl.
Yeah. Cecilia.
Cecilia, yeah.
Now, on Monday, June 11th, detectives spoke to Cecilia, but it wasn't until Thursday that Cecilia told all. Now, Cecilia and Pam, despite their age differences, had become BFFs. Two of them, along with Billy, would hang out all the time, and knowing what she knew, the police convinced Cecilia to wear a wire to record conversations with Pam. The police set up two brief telephone intercepts and fixed Cecilia up with two body wire sessions. On one such recording, Cecilia asks, quote, "Seeing what happened, wouldn't you rather have just divorced Greg?" And Pam replies, "Well, I don't know, you know. Nothing was going wrong until they fucking told Ralph." Cut to Wednesday, August 1st, 1990, at 1:05 p.m., Detective Daniel Pelletier. On Wednesday, August 1st.
Well, you know that in New Hampshire, they call it Pelletier.
Pelletier.
Yeah. I'm
French.
Or Bienvenue. Yeah, they
Bienvenue.
Benoit instead of Benoit.
Yeah. Well, then I'm doing it the way that you do. So on Wednesday, August 1st, 1990, at 1:05 p.m., Detective Daniel Pelletier entered Smart's office unannounced, and Pam recognized him, having spoken to him on at least six other occasions. "Hi," said Pamela. "Hi," he replied as Captain Jackson and another detective stepped into the room. Taken by surprise, Pam asked, "What's up?" "Well, Pam," Pelletier said, "I have some good news, and I have some bad news. And the good news is that we've solved the murder of your husband. The bad news is you're under arrest." "What for?" she asks. "First degree murder. Stand up and face the wall." Dun, dun, dun.
Straight Zoinks. Out of Columbo. Zoinks. Jinkies. I know. It's some Columbo shit right here. So Smart's trial was widely watched and garnered considerable media attention, partly because it was one of the first in the U.S. to allow TV cameras in the courtroom. She faced life in prison if convicted. The prosecution's case relied heavily on testimony from Smart's teenaged co-conspirators who had secured their own plea bargains before her trial began. When oral arguments began, March 4th, 1991, Assistant Attorney General Diane Nicolosi portrayed the teenagers as naive victims of a, quote, evil woman bent on murder, end quote. The prosecution portrayed Pamela Smart as the cold-blooded mastermind who controlled her underage sex partner. Nicolosi claimed that Smart seduced Flynn to get him to murder her husband so that she could avoid an expensive divorce and benefit from a $140,000 life insurance policy.
Ooh, ding, ding.
Mm-hmm. Which doesn't sound, I mean, in those days, I guess there was a lot, but it doesn't sound like that much money, you know. In her testimony, Smart acknowledged that she had what she termed an affair with the underage boy, but claimed that the murder of her husband was solely the doing of Flynn and his friends as a reaction to her telling Flynn that she wished to end their relationship and repair her marriage. She insisted that she neither participated in the murder plot nor had any foreknowledge of it. And after a 14-day trial that culminated on March 22nd, 1991, in the Rockingham County Superior Court, Smart was found guilty of being an accomplice to first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and witness tampering. The tampering stemmed from Pam's coercing Cecilia not to say anything to authorities or to lie. The conviction was largely the result of the testimony of her co-conspirators and secretly taped conversations in which Smart appeared to contradict her claims of having wanted to reconcile with her husband and of having no knowledge of the boy's plot. She could have been charged with capital murder, but the prosecution decided against it. Later that day, she was given a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. In 1992, William Flynn was sentenced to life in prison for second-degree murder, not eligible for parole for 40 years, with 12 years of the minimum sentence deferred if he maintains good behavior. And Flynn was granted parole by the State Parole Board on March 12, 2015, and was released from prison with lifetime parole on June 4, 2015, a few days past the 25th anniversary of Greg Smart's death. Like Flynn, Patrick Randall was also sentenced to life in prison for second-degree murder, eligible for parole after 40 years with 12 years deferred. He was released on June 4th, 2015, on lifetime parole, the same day as co-conspirator Flynn's release and a few days past the 25th anniversary of Greg Smart's death. Co-conspirator and driver Vance Latimé was sentenced to life in prison as an accomplice to second-degree murder, eligible for parole after 30 years with 12 years suspended, making him eligible in 2008. In 2005, his minimum sentence was reduced by 3 years, and he was paroled that same year, 15 years after Greg Smart's death. Co-conspirator Raymond Fowler, who waited in the car during the killing, was sentenced to 30 years for conspiracy to murder and attempted burglary and parole eligibility after 15 years. Fowler was paroled in 2003, 13 years after Greg Smart's death, but was sent back to prison in 2004 for violating his parole terms. He was paroled again the following year in June 2005. And finally, Smart is serving her life sentence at the maximum security Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women in Westchester County, New York, where she was transferred in 1993 from the New Hampshire State Prison for Women in Goffstown. At the time, New Hampshire officials said the transfer was for unspecified security reasons. Well, it might have been threats of what I'm about to say, which happened in the New York prison, which was that in October 1996, Smart was severely beaten by two fellow inmates that resulted in the insertion of a plastic plate in the left side of her face. As a result of the beating, she takes medication for chronic pain and sometimes thinks of suicide. Yeah. Her counselor, Dr. Eleanor Pam, says that, quote, she has many, many, many dark days, end quote. Smart says she still keeps track of Flynn because she regards him as being the key to her freedom. She says, quote, he is one of the few people that could actually get me out of here by coming forward and telling the truth, but he's never going to do that, end quote. And that, my dear old friend and my dear new friend, is the case of Pamela Smart. So there you go.
Holy moly.
Yeah. I remember Billy Flynn's testimony. Do you remember that, Sarah? The
no.
boy? I remember all of us kind of, well, I think I was still in New Hampshire and I was doing shows at the Palace and, you know, all the usual suspects were there and we were talking about it all the time. And we were all sort of taken by Billy's testimony and it was so believable. And to your point earlier about people being able to change, he was truly grieving on the stand and truly remorseful. I know that he apologized to the family. I can't believe I'm saying this because poor Greg Smart was murdered and his parents, I remember their pain and they were so devastated that they'll never have their son back. At the same time, Billy Flynn was truly, you could see that how devastated he was and how much he regretted what he did. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons he was released because we always just say that we felt bad for him. You know,
because an authority figure was telling him to do something. Like, I never thought to question grown-ups when I was young.
I mean, add a layer of an intimate relationship with somebody who you find to be an authoritative figure, and then on top of that, manipulation station, which she was clearly very good at. I probably would have listened to his testimony and felt bad for him as well. And thought, you know, somebody in his position has the ability to rehab themselves or change. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. He was a kid.
I wonder if, like, he, you know how sometimes that Billy Flynn person forms kind of a bond with, like, this, you know, Greg Smart's parents or, you know
yes.
what I mean? Like, because they have this bond that only they share really in a fucked up way, you know?
Well, yeah. It's like I was watching something recently, maybe court cam, whatever. And I was watching it, and the mother of
the
slain. Yes.
Sorry. Go on.
Don't be. We're here. Yeah. We're here to
Thank
hear you,
you,
dear.
Thank you. Sarah knows exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah, court cam on A&E, for those of you who want to watch it, and those of you who we know already do. There was this episode of court cam where this kid killed another gentleman, and the one who was killed, his mother took the stand, but she got up to give remarks to the judge and to the court, and she basically just said to his mother, you know, your son is still with us and you have the burden of him being taken away from you but still being alive when mine is no longer with us, and I forgive you for doing this and I will work with you and stay in your life every single day to help you. And it just,
yeah,
am I getting that right, this. Sarah? If you saw it, I saw that. Said, can I hug him? And it was just big. It really made you, it made me, I have to say, question the strength of people, because that takes a shit ton of strength. And
he just melted in her arms, you know, I mean.
Yeah. And the two mothers hugged. And of course it was, that was because crazy to watch.
The boys were friends, correct? They knew one another, if I recall.
I don't know if they knew one another.
I'm not sure.
But she was just saying, you know, you are a kid and you did this thing and now you're going to be put away for the rest of your life and I'm still going to stay in your life because I believe in forgiveness. And she, you know, was very, very spiritual and, you know, she hugged his mother and said, you know, I'm also going to be here for you. And to me, that is utter strength of somebody who's way evolved.
And with all due respect, I don't think that was the case here because Billy Flynn was up for parole prior to when he was actually paroled and he did apologize to them. And, you know, they still were not in favor of his early release. I know that, you know, which how can you blame them, you know, but to each his own and it's different for everyone. But I do remember that case and that is pretty extraordinary. Are you, Sarah Silverman. Thank you so much for giving us your time. She's giving us
the hear.
Yeah. No, I really appreciate you.
Well, thanks for having me.
It was so nice to meet you, Sarah. But thank you so much on such a fucked up day for coming and talking to us about this.
Is it you guys singing in the theme song?
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Love that. Yeah, I just love when y'all sing.
Oh, Mom.
Well, for those of you who don't know, Sarah, too, you're a tremendous singer. You know, I remember.
I'm a very good singer for a comedian, but I'm not a good singer for a singer.
I remember. I don't know if you remember, but I remember. You loved Little Shop of Horrors when it came out, and you loved Audrey, and I think that's a role you have yet to play because.
I would love to see that.
No, I'm telling you. We need Sarah Silverman as Audrey, y'all. And
We did hair together.
We did hair together. And you sang the lead in Black Boys.
I did. Mm-hmm. And what did you sing? I sang
Welcome, Sulfur Dioxide. I was Jeannie. Yeah.
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 And
oh,
you know who else was in that? Do you remember John Ennis?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
He played Wolf.
Yeah.
And then he went on to, dated my sister, later that year. And in Boston, and then he moved to LA, and he was in Mr. Show, and he's like part of that whole gang.
Get it, John Ennis?
Yeah,
that's fabulous.
And his daughter's an actress now. Oh my god,
daughter!
But I remember his audition for some reason.
Oh, because remember we all had to audition in front of one another.
Ooh,
yeah.
Ooh,
that. And I didn't know who this guy was, but he was this big guy with big blonde, long curly locks, and he was wearing a tie dye full head to toe. And he sang the song like the best he could. And he goes, oh, man, that sounded better in the car. You know, and everyone loved him.
I remember that. Well, we love you. Thank you so much. And,
dude,
thank you. I think I spoke over you. Tell me you love me again.
I love you, too.
Thanks.
You're very special to me.
You're and special Jessica, to me.
You're starting to be.
I knew.
Yeah.
I knew it would be. I knew this time would be really, really good for us. Nothing better on impeachment day. So, yeah.
Well, Sarah, thank you for your heart. All right. Bye.
Bye, girl. That was great.
Isn't she great?
She's wonderful.
She's so sweet. Well, I love her. I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
I will tell you, I also such a big fan of Sarah's for so long in very many ways. She's truly a wonderful human being. And so happy that she came on to discuss this wickety wild wackadoo case. Truly. I'm going to watch some documentaries now that I've probably seen before, but I'm going to go back and watch some Pam Smart stuff.
Yeah, I am. I'm going to go back and I'm going to watch Murder in New Hampshire again, I think. Because I saw it. And you know what? I don't think I've ever watched To Die For. I'm going to go watch that. That's what I'm going to do. Because I remember when it came out and, I don't think I ever saw it, so I got to do that.
That feels right. And you know what, killers? If you want to take a watch, take a listen, do it. Because on top of everything else, we love you. And we so appreciate you being here today. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content and follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.